Climate change, it's more than just a catchphrase. For millions of young people around the world, it has become a rallying cry, a desperate cry for their future. In recent weeks, young people around the world staged a global climate strike, and from Baltimore to Belfast, millions of them walked out of classes and held mass rallies demanding that policymakers take drastic steps to save the planet. I'm Renee Kemp, in for Rose Aguilar. Coming up on your call, we'll talk to three environmental activists who are this year's winners of the Brower Youth Awards. We'll discuss how they're taking action to save their world. That's just ahead on your call right after the news. Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. Climate change, we've heard those words linked together for at least the last 20 or so years, and it is the leading issue of a generation. For Generation Z, environmental justice has become a leading movement. Just a little less than a month ago, over 4 million people worldwide participated in the first ever global climate strike. It was largely inspired by students and young people who walked out of their schools around the world to protest climate change. But the youth today are not just protesting. They're actually getting busy. They're taking action. They are leading. They're founding their own grassroots movements, and they're coming up with their own solutions. For 20 years now, the Brower Youth Awards have reinvented what it means to be an environmental activist. Generations of winners have now reimagined their world. They've rethought the possibilities, and they've begun to meet the demands of critical environmental problems that young people are facing. And the 20th annual Brower Youth Award ceremony is taking place tonight. That's at 7:30 in Herbst Theater at the San Francisco War Memorial Veterans Building. In case you get a chance to go, you'll be inspired, I'm sure. But as a bit of a preview, we have with us in studio now three of this year's six winning environmental leaders. And they're so young, it's extraordinary that we can call them leaders, but that's precisely what they are. Starting with Isra Hirsi. Isra is a 16-year-old from Minneapolis, Minnesota. She's co-founder and co-executive director, at the age of 16, mind you, of the U.S. Youth Climate Strike, which had its first national strike in March of this year. Isra became passionate about environmental activism after witnessing pipelines being built in her home state of Minnesota. She also saw extreme snow conditions start to show up on the forecast year after year. And then finally, after hearing about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, Isra Hirsi founded the Youth Climate Strike on the premise that climate change has a disproportionate impact on black and brown communities. And by the way, Isra's mom is Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who's, of course, among the most vocal proponents of the Green New Deal. So Isra's work is in many ways an extension of her environmental justice platform and her family's work. So, Isra Hirsi, thank you so much for being here. And, of course, congratulations on creating your own powerful movement. So glad to have you here.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having us here.
Second, Shannon Lisa. Shannon is 21 years old, and she's from Avenel, New Jersey. She's the program director, again, at the age of 21, the program director of the nonprofit Edison Wetlands Association. That organization investigates the effects of chemical contaminant dumping in the state of Indiana and beyond. In mid-2017, Shannon learned that dozens of kids were getting sick with rare cancers in the city of Franklin, Indiana. And Shannon decided to work with the small community group called If It Was Your Child. She worked with that group and an environmental technical team to conduct the first ever scientific testing of residential indoor air. And what they found was staggering. They discovered that some homes in that city had levels of industrial toxins up to 18 times higher than the state threshold. And thanks to her research, it led to the Environmental Protection Agency reopening a wide-scale investigation. So, Shannon, Lisa, you are proof positive that one person can move a mountain, even if it's the size of the EPA. So it's remarkable. Congratulations on being a winner, and thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having us all here.
Absolutely. Last but not least, we're joined by Isha Clark. Isha is a 16-year-old from Oakland, and she's one of the original members of a group, possibly very aptly, called Youth Versus Apocalypse. That group is a diverse gathering of young people, activists who are protesting a coal terminal, which was and still is apparently going to be built in an underserved community of color in Oakland. Back on March 15th of this year, Isha and Youth Versus Apocalypse organized the Bay Area Youth Climate Strike. Isha advocates for radical climate action, and she does work with frontline communities, and she believes that environmental racism is a key part of securing environmental justice. Thank you so much, Isha, for being here. And again, congratulations on being a winner of the award this year and for your hard work.
Thank you for having me.
Wish the listeners could see these fresh young faces. You'd be so impressed. These are basically children. And try to remember what you were doing when you were 16, right? And imagine doing the kind of work that these three young women are doing. It's remarkable. And I imagine our listeners will probably have some questions for you. So we're going to invite them to call as soon as they'd like at 866-798-8255, or they can send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. So congratulations. Let's do a deep dive and talk about the incredible work that you've done. But let's start with you, Isra Hirsi. Why is the climate movement the thing that got you animated and got you busy?
Yeah, so growing up in the Midwest, I always saw extreme snow conditions, and there is a pipeline being built a few hours away from my home. And so the more that I heard about it and the more that I learned that a lot of communities where I'm from didn't know about the issue, I realized how big of a problem it was. And so I recognized that there was an opportunity to get involved by joining my school's environmental club when I first entered high school, and then also just moving forward and doing local actions and local policies to make sure that those communities I didn't know are the ones that aren't being impacted by this crisis. And then I knew that I had the ability to use my voice to actually create change.
But why did you feel like you could make a difference? Most of us feel swamped by the immensity of this issue.
Yeah, so I kind of grew up, thinking that I could change the world. I remember being really little and going to protests with my family in, like, the first grade and, like, knowing that I had the ability to do things like run for president when I was older. And so I always grew up being the type of person to always go to protests, learn more, and also always want to take action. I've always been a very politically involved child, and so it's been pretty easy for me to, like, find my way into organizing and to attending and to creating real change.
And it didn't hurt that your mom, Ilhan Omar, has certainly been an activist. So you grew up with a sign in your hand.
Yeah, my mother actually took me to my first protest in the first grade. And so it's kind of been pretty easy to, like, get involved in politics and in advocacy in elementary school. And so I guess her leadership and my father's leadership has led me to be able to create my own.
All right, Shannon, Lisa.
Hi.
You first became aware of environmental issues through some firsthand experience of your own. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So I grew up in the state of New Jersey, right in central New Jersey. And I remember from a very young age as a child, I loved two things the most, animals and playing in the dirt. Mm. And I drove my parents crazy for tracking dirt in the house. And one of my favorite things to do was gardening outside with my grandfather. You know, my state has the most toxic waste sites in the country, the densest population size, some of the highest cancer rates in the country. And he created that little natural oasis, you know, in the middle of all that for me. I went through high school, did the normal path, but right around my junior and senior year, I was diagnosed with a heart condition, and my grandfather also passed away from bladder cancer around the same time, and my eyes were opened up more and more to these contaminated lands that surrounded me and potentially what that was doing to my health and the health of the people around me. And I realized that agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, their mission statement includes both the environment and human health for a reason. So that really pulled me into getting involved in the issues, and I found my way to my organization, Edison Wetlands Association, and built my way up over time.
Now, of course, that was a time in your junior year when most people are thinking about junior proms. not environmental disasters. Did you find when you kind of woke up to this issue that you were a bit of an outlier, or when you started to look for like-minded folks, did you find that there were other young people who were interested in this issue?
Definitely. You know, it was a tough road at first because it's something that you're not used to seeing around your high school, someone really digging in, you know, not only into environmental issues, but into a toxic waste issue, which is so complex and not talked about nearly enough. So, you know, I really felt that while I was growing up in my state, the environmental problems facing our generation that we were left with, too, were growing. And I'm the kind of person that When I see a problem, I don't like to back down, so I couldn't turn away.
You're the kind of person that I think a lot of these heavy industries fear, someone who's just not afraid, not afraid. And in a couple of years ago, in mid-2017 or so, you learned that dozens of kids were getting sick. So do you feel that your condition and that of your grandfather are directly related to what was going on in the environment? Because you found in Franklin, Indiana, that there were cases of rare cancers, kids getting sick. So were you able to draw a parallel between the environment and some of those illnesses?
Yeah, look, you know, I really recognized in myself what I suffered through. My heart went out to the families of Franklin, Indiana, so much more. And while it's so difficult to, you know, link a specific health condition to an environmental exposure, you know, we're learning more and more the role that toxic waste plays in our health. And there was actually a study that really made me look at the issues more. It was done by Janet Curry of Columbia University that showed that when contaminated sites are cleaned up, children's health improves by up to 20% to 25%. So there's something really meaningful in getting together and trying to remediate these lands that, you know, were once blighted.
Finally, Isha.
Hi.
Hi. Isha Clark, you began your activism right in your own backyard in Oakland, California, and it started in 2017. You say that you attended a youth-led action that was targeting a developer who was hoping to build a coal terminal right through West Oakland. Talk about that project and how that got you involved.
Yeah, so when I was a freshman in high school, I was 13, I was invited to this action that was targeting Phil Tagami, who's a very prominent developer in Oakland, and is actually suing the city of Oakland to be able to build this coal terminal through West Oakland, which is a predominantly low-income of color community. And so at this action, we dressed up as elves. The theme was Christmas in June, and we had this scroll that said, it was signed by a bunch of kids in Oakland saying, "We don't want coal for Christmas." And so we went to his office, and we were expecting, you know, to just give the scroll to the secretary and say, "Oh, he'll get back to you," you know, but we wound up running into him on his way to the bathroom. And so we had this really heated exchange where I was, a bunch of us, there was like 10 or 15 young people and some adult allies that were there. And we were basically saying, like, this coal is going to poison our communities. We're already struggling. We already have extremely high rates of asthma and lung disease and so many other things that are connected to bad air quality that would be exacerbated by this coal terminal. And he was like, "Well, you don't have all the information, and there's like another side to the story that isn't being told." And so I stepped up, and my hands were shaking and my heart was racing, and I was like, "Well, tell us the other side of the story." And he was like shocked. He wasn't expecting this 13-year-old girl to challenge him, right? He's this powerful, wealthy developer. And in that moment, I realized my own power, and I realized the importance of this movement and how historically in climate movements and environmental movements, it's been old white people. And that doesn't reflect the population that's actually being impacted by these issues. And so that was a very, it was an inflection point for me where I was like, this is what I need to be doing. This is so important.
And where did you get that kind of chutzpah?
You know, I don't know. I come from a lot of social justice. I grew up listening to my grandpa's stories about burning his draft papers and peeing in front of the Koch brothers building in protest and so many other amazing things. And, you know, social justice has always been normal in my family, and conversations about social justice are everywhere. We talk about it on Thanksgiving, on Passover, on, you know, just regular dinners. We're always talking about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And what is the status of that terminal now in the Bay Area?
Yeah, so unfortunately, Phil Tagami won the first lawsuit, but now it's going to the appeals court, I believe. And we're honestly not exactly sure what's going on with that, but we know for sure that the fight is not over, and we will not rest until that coal terminal is completely terminated.
And how do you come up against moneyed interests like that? Because invariably they have political power, they have financial leverage. How do you come up against an entity that is that amorphous?
You know, I like to say that everyone that's powerful gets their power from the people. And so if we pressure powerful people and we start putting pressure on their money, which is coming from us, then they're powerless. And so we have to realize that every person that's in power, whether that's from, you know, corporations or politics, they are fueled by people power. And so if we stand together and work against them and put pressure on them, then we can succeed and we can make them change.
Shannon, I'll ask you, what does that look like? Does that mean getting in the streets with a placard? Does it mean registering voters? Does it mean laying your body across a developer's office door? What does that look like?
Sure. I think it includes all of the above. You know, something I like to say is I kind of like being on the outside because I like playing the role of the thorn, you know, the thorn in an industry side. And, you know, it has to include the information, the facts, the policy, and the data side, but it definitely has to include that human aspect, too, and getting people out in the streets. You know, one thing we did in Franklin, Indiana, actually, is we worked with the community to send 600 postcards to EPA. And these postcards were designed to look like your standard vacation postcard that said, hey, EPA, wish you were here in Franklin. And they had 600 of those stacked on their desks that they had to sort through and scan and file away because of, you know, FOIA, Freedom of Information Act laws. And that's, you know, that's part of the puzzle, too, is really being a thorn in the side and not, you know, refusing to back down until your voice is heard.
And being creative. I mean, that was really clever, right?
Yeah.
Not to mention the elves with the coal and the Christmas stocking that Isha was talking about, because these are such existential issues. They're so deep that most people just don't want to think about it. Not to mention the fact that it's in the future and people are so concerned with their immediate comfort or issues that it's hard to talk about, you know, what's possible in the next 20 to 30 years. But Isra Hirsi, one of the things that you were concerned about was the year 2030, yes? Why is that year important to you?
Yeah, so my little sister, she's 7, and she's supposed to graduate high school in 2030, so she's supposed to turn 18. And thinking about that year is really scary for me because I know that, you know, I have the ability to at least have a childhood and at least grow up, even though there is this impending crisis, but this crisis is entirely her life. That sense of urgency, that scary, terrifying thought is always going to be in her head, and at least I have the ability to, you know, grow up and at least, you know, go to middle school without having to think about it every 2 seconds. And she doesn't have that luxury. You know, she sees her older sister going to climate strikes. She comes with me to them sometimes. And it's really, really terrifying for her. But also, touching on to the point where you're talking about how it's up in the future, my parents are from Somalia, and Somalia has had extreme droughts in the past few years where there are millions displaced because it's a very farmland country and their agriculture is dying, and so millions of people don't have access to food, and it's causing hungers because they don't have water and things like that. And so this crisis is far away for some, but for others it's right here and right now, and that's extremely terrifying to think about.
You know, there's so many movies and other media out there that have this apocalyptic view of what the world will look like. And attempts to keep the climate temperature from increasing by, what is it, 1.5 degrees Celsius, don't seem to be hitting the benchmarks. When you think about what 2030 is going to look like, Israel, what do you honestly think? Are we going to be able to breathe the air? What do you think it's going to look like?
Yeah, it's a really extremely scary and concerning thought. I often like to think about it in a positive light, as if we get a president that cares about the climate crisis, and we get things like the Green New Deal, but if that doesn't end up happening, you know, we see millions and billions of people experiencing what's happening in places like Somalia and Bangladesh, where you have extreme droughts, increased hurricanes and tornadoes, pipelines being built everywhere, horrible water quality and air quality, and it gets to the point where people can't even breathe and drink clean water, not just in communities of color, but everywhere. You know, everybody feels that discomfort. And to some extent, sometimes it might have to get to that point where everybody realizes that it's an important issue, because right now there's so many people who get to live in that comfort and others that get to breathe that horrible air quality. And so it's very terrifying, but at least there are people out there, like the people sitting next to me right now, that are out there on the streets trying to make that change.
But you guys are in people's faces, really. I mean, it's like you were one of the young people who got in Senator Dianne Feinstein's face, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, how'd that go?
Yeah, that was a frustrating experience. And, you know, it was so similar to the one that I had with Phil Tagami. And mm-hmm. so I kind of like clicked back into that space, you know, where I was like, this has to be said, and I felt fearless, you know? And I think what I like to say about that interaction is that it's not just about Senator Feinstein, but it's about all of the politicians who are in this really unique position of power and aren't using that to be advocates, you know? We went to her office to ask her to vote yes on the resolution for the Green New Deal. Which is going to get us to net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, which was said to be kind of our last opportunity to make real change before it becomes irreversible. And while doing that creates this just transition, which is where people who are working in the fossil fuel industry, like coal miners, will be transitioned to green jobs where they have equal or higher pay than they did before, and creates opportunities for low-income black and brown people to be getting jobs with livable wages and benefits. And so it's this revolutionary plan that really is encompassing both the science that says that we only have until 2030 to do something, and this justice aspect. I think something that's really important to mention is that this crisis, while so scary, presents this really unique opportunity to completely reimagine the way that we live in this world, because all of these systems of oppression that undergird our world have fueled this crisis. In order to really solve the crisis, we have to completely undo all of those systems of oppression. And so it's incredibly scary, but this is the fight of all fights, in my opinion.
I saw that video. And I must say, I thought Dianne Feinstein was already on the side of the Green New Deal. And how come you're not in the face of Republicans who are, who are not the least bit interested in that kind of legislation?
Right. I think we need to cover all sides. But I think we also need to check our own people right now, you know, because there's a lot of progressive, quote unquote, politicians that aren't taking bold enough actions. And I think it's more a reality that we'll be able to get our own, quote unquote, people on the side of the Green New Deal than to try to change Republican minds. So I think we need to focus on the progressives that aren't doing enough, because that's what they're supposed to be doing, you know?
Push them out of that comfort zone.
Right.
It's amazing. We're talking today with three winners of this year's 20th Annual Brower Youth Awards. Those awards recognize outstanding youth leaders making strides in the environmental movement. The award ceremony is taking place tonight at 7:30 in the Herbst Theater in the San Francisco War Memorial Veterans Building. Hope you'll stay with us. We've got three activists who have some ideas about how we can fix the mess that the planet is in. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email your call at KALW.org. or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. The crisis in northern Syria and making the daily difference with John Kasich coming up on 1A, 11 o'clock, 1/2 hour from now, here on 91.7 KLW.
For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call. We are podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And you can also listen to past shows there in the archive section and sign up for the newsletter. It's a lot of fun. That helps you find out what's coming up next on the show. And you can leave your show ideas for us. That's at yourcall@kalw.org. Tomorrow, on the Next Your Call, we'll be rebroadcasting a conversation with award-winning journalist Abigail Pesta. She has a new book. It's called The Girls, An All-American Town, A Predatory Doctor, and the Untold Story of the Gymnasts Who Brought Him Down. It's really a fascinating book. We meet the brave young women who brought down Dr. Larry Nassar, and she'll discuss how he was able to get away with decades of sexual abuse of young premier gymnasts. Hope you'll join that conversation with Rose Aguilar and you on the next Your Call. Today, we're talking with three young environmental activists. Isra Hersey is with the Youth Climate Strike. Shannon Lisa is with the Edison Wetlands Association. And Isha Clark is with Youth Versus Apocalypse. If you have questions for them, 866-798-8255 is the number to call. Shannon, let's go back to you. How important do you think it is for young people to be engaged? Again, you know, folks over 30 probably feel like there's a certain way to go about making change, whether it's legislation, changing laws, voting people in or out. Why do you think it's important for young people to take their own particular approach to this?
Yeah, you know, I think us being young people, all six of us winners, really was a strength in our movements because, at least for me, when I was just getting started, it was such a benefit to almost not know what I didn't know yet, you know, not know the status quo of how to do things, you know, being able to dive right in and get started. And I think that that's such a strength. And the reality of the situation is, isn't it so twisted, the fact that, you know, young people, our communities, our nonprofits have to step up and, quite frankly, do the job of the federal government because they're not taking action or proper action on these issues.
Well, speaking of the federal government, what is the role of the government, the EPA? Or is that just an outdated way to even think about this thing?
Yeah, the EPA's stated mission is, you know, protection of human health and the environment. And, you know, as we've seen, they've really been dropping the ball on many of these communities, Franklin, Indiana being one of them. This site that we were looking into and we are still continuing to research and move forward on was an environmental cold case for about 30 years. The Environmental Protection Agency believed this site to be cleaned, to be cleaned up, and that no contamination was migrating beyond the industrial facility. And, you know, through months of hard work and coming in and collecting our own independent data, we found that not to be true. And we were able to move the agency, you know, in such a stormy political time, especially with this administration and the shutdown of the EPA that we also had to ride the wave through. You know, it's been an incredible effort to have to do that. But, you know, that really was done with the community stepping up and sharing their stories as well. Because as I mentioned before, it's not all about the data and it's not all about the science and rattling off facts. It's the human side and humans sharing their own stories and experiences that we're able to make change.
But how can you not be disheartened? I mean, I look at the fact that the EPA has been absolutely gutted. And in fact, in a real sense, the person put in charge of the EPA is anti-EPA. So how do you not get disheartened? when you see the direction that things appear to be going.
Yeah, it's so easy to get unmotivated when all those things are stacked against you. But I think all of us here choose to be motivated by something much stronger. And like Isha said, that's opportunity. And it's the opportunity to see a problem, and that's the area where you can make the most change. So that's really where we've directed our efforts. You know, the toxic waste issue has been an issue that I feel has not been getting enough attention in the environmental movement. But I think all of us here, you know, are all connected. These are all environmental issues that are interconnected. Climate change has very much to do with the toxic waste crisis and vice versa. And so, you know, maybe I'm going out on a limb here, but that's kind of what got me to this place anyway. I really do think that this strong group of women is going to continue working together in solving these issues long after we leave the Bay Area and leave this award.
It hasn't escaped my notice that you're all three young women. I think that's notable. Let's just say it's really remarkable. But, you know, I guess for those who are just watching things unfold on the national and international scale, you'd pretty much have to have your head in the sand not to recognize that something's different. Things are changing, whether it was watching the Amazon forest being burned deliberately to create farmland or these major mega storms, or on the micro, not just the macro, but the micro. It was the Flint water crisis, for example, Isra Hirsi, who that got you really involved. How did the Flint water crisis spark your interest?
Learning a lot about how, you know, there are thousands upon thousands of people in Flint, Michigan without water quality was insane to me. You know, I would read about it and places like in Newark, New Jersey, and other places all across the country where people didn't have good water quality, and I thought that was a basic human right. And the more that I learned, the more that I realized it's not just Flint, Michigan, and it's not, you know, in just a few little places. It was happening in the city that I live in a predominantly black neighborhood, and the lead crisis is insane to me about how many communities of color are being impacted and how little local governments and the United States federal government was doing to change this crisis. And so the more that I learned about it, the more I realized that this is not an injustice that the government's going to solve and that the people have to do it. And it's kind of why I felt like it's important to make sure to get involved and to talk about these issues.
Hard to believe, but it's been 5 years since the Flint water crisis was first discovered. And what was your takeaway?
Yeah, you know, they still don't even have 100% clean water.
And they still don't, yeah.
Exactly. And Little Miss Flint has been, you know, raising thousands upon thousands of dollars to get clean water for her community, but she's literally 12 years old and doing it all by herself. And so the more that you realize how big of an issue it is, the bigger you realize that young people do have, you know, the power to create real change. Because if she can raise thousands upon thousands of dollars for her community in middle school, then we all have the ability to create real change. And so, like, learning about people like Little Miss Flint and how those communities are becoming self-sustaining for their own clean water is what keeps me going, because I know there is still a reason to stay optimistic.
Isha Clark, your organization, Youth Versus Apocalypse, every time I think about that title, I think, yikes. Mm. You know, there's so much at stake here. And I'm wondering, as you engage in direct action, when you're out there on the front lines, is it mostly young folks, or are there, let's just call them more mature folks out there too? And do you kind of hope that the old folks will just kind of step aside, get out of the way, and let young people do this?
You know, I think it's been really amazing, all of the youth leadership that's come out of this movement. And I think that the adults that I've been working with are really there for us and are really allowing young people to lead the way and are kind of like, well, what should we do? What can we do to help you? And so I think that's new and that's really powerful. And, you know, it's not about mature folks stepping out of the way. It's about allowing young people to lead the way and having adults supporting us. I think that will create the most powerful movement, because we're not saying that adults are incapable of creating change, because that's just not true. And in fact, a lot of organizers, adult organizers that I've been working with, have been doing this for decades. And so they have experience that's valuable to the movement. But it's about allowing young people to be the visionaries for our own futures and being supported by this experience that creates the most powerful movement possible.
And talk a bit, if you will, about the intersection of racial justice and environmental justice.
Yes. So, you know, I think it's really evident in the coal terminal. They're planning to build the coal terminal through West Oakland, which is a community that is predominantly Black.
And this is a place where they intend to store large caches of coal? Is that the idea?
So it's going to be a terminal. So what will happen is they're going to be shipping coal through Oakland to be exported to places like China. And so the problem with that is that because of safety reasons, you can't cover what the coal's being held in. So coal dust flies into the air, and that's extremely bad for people's health. And on top of that, you know, even if it's not going to be burned in Oakland, it's going to be burned somewhere in the world, and that impacts this global climate change. And, you know, they would never put that coal terminal in a white community or in a wealthy community. And we saw that with the Dakota Access Pipeline. That pipeline was actually being planned to go through another community that I believe was above the reservation. And they decided not to do that because it was going to mess up the water resources for people there. And so they moved it to go across this reservation. And the exact same thing would happen there, but they decided that they didn't care because that's an indigenous population. And that is so blatant that environmental racism is a large fuel of the climate crisis, because there's been this complete disregard for the humanity of people of color, and specifically low-income communities of color.
And is it possible to quantify the health outcomes that you say are the result, perhaps, of this kind of environmental racism?
Yeah. I mean, West Oakland already has really high rates of asthma and other health issues that are connected to bad air quality, as I said before. And that is just going to, those numbers are going to continue to increase. And I'm sure that hopefully, like, we do not want this coal terminal to happen. But if it does, we will see that reflected in the data, that people's health are getting increasingly worse.
We have someone on the line who wants to ask you specifically, what is Mayor Libby Schaaf of Oakland? What is her position on this? And is she helping or hurting your cause?
You know, that situation is very complicated, to be honest. The city is fighting against Phil Tagami because he's suing them, but there are some complicated relationships between Phil Tagami and the city because he's such a prominent developer and he's worked with the city a lot to develop. And so it's hard because they're fighting against Tagami because he's suing them, but they also have this longstanding relationship, which I'm sure has slowed this process.
Well, that's politics. And yeah. Shannon, Lisa, I'm sure that in your work you have come up against the impediments that politics, you know, almost necessarily require. There's going to be political pushback. How do you get past those political obstacles?
Yeah, definitely. It's always looking for that next level of pressure you can apply. And like you said as well, being creative with it, doing the unexpected. We had a lot of dismissiveness and pushback from the EPA at first, so much so that we worked hard to kind of bring, you know, bring Mama Bear into the picture, which is the EPA Office of Inspector General. Mm-hmm. And we put together in December, which was the time that the government shutdown was going on, and EPA was out of business for that time, quite frankly. We filed a 30-page request to the Office of Inspector General and trying to get them involved and in. The EPA was already missing their deadlines for conducting winter sampling of the homes in Indiana, which is so important because, you know, that's considered to be a very vulnerable time for some of these contaminants to migrate into homes because people have their heat cranked up and their windows closed and everything kind of remains in that indoor air. And so we made the decision at that point, too. If EPA isn't going to do it, then we'll take on the job of the federal government and we'll go in and do independent sampling for the winter as well, which we got done.
How'd you pull that off?
A lot of organization, you know, a lot of reaching out to homeowners and explaining the issues. And, you know, it's not only about reaching out to those in positions of power and elected officials and being that voice, you know, to that group. But it's really bringing it back down and reaching out to those who don't normally speak up, who might not know the issues, being able to empower everyone to have a voice, giving them the factual information that they desire, but they don't know where to start. And I think so many people are fearful of stepping up and speaking out. You know, it's such a strange issue because there's such urgency with this environmental crisis that, you know, I think many of us feel like we have to speak up, but at first we might be afraid to say the wrong thing. You know, but I think you don't have to wait for anybody to give you permission to be an advocate for your environment, because this is something we all share, and no one should have to get sick because they happen to be born in the wrong zip code.
And if you want to have proof that a push like yours can work, the EPA has actually reopened that case, right?
Yes, they have. Yes. You know, the site is well on its way to getting to a complete and permanent cleanup, and we're still working with the community, and we're still commenting on EPA decisions and providing our own data when we can. But things are moving forward, and the first stage of a cleanup has started in that community as well, with repairing leaking sewer lines. That was one of the major points by which contamination had spread through the city, was that this industrial company had discharged their waste directly through the city's sewer lines, where it migrated underground. So that is the first stage that is now in the works through the winter, and we're definitely moving forward and going to keep pushing. And the highlight here, too, is that unfortunately, you know, Franklin, Indiana, and my state of New Jersey are not anomalies. Industry really has left no corner of the United States free from being its own private dumping ground. So this is something that, you know, whether you're from a red state or a blue state, you know, we all have a shared stake in needing clean air, clean water, and a safe place to raise our families. And I think that that is an American right, and that is a global right that we all have that we need to fight for.
Isra Hersey, I can't imagine what it must be like when you grow up in a family that is activist. Your mom, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, has faced blistering attacks. I mean, blistering attacks. Doesn't that kind of give you pause when you see that your mom is taking incoming the way she has?
Yes, my mom survived war. You know, she lived in a refugee camp for 4 years, and she came to the United States. And so every single time I ask her how she's doing, she says that she's fine, and that, you know, this isn't anything to her because, you know, she survived, you know, bullets and bombings in her home country. And so knowing that my mother's a really strong woman means that these little comments that people are making about her from, you know, the occupant of the White House doesn't mean anything, because they have no value, because, you know, my mother taught me and my siblings that we believe in our own beliefs and we don't, you know, listen to what people have to say about us, because, you know, all these little comments are nothing. They're just really far from the truth. And so I know that my mother is going to be fine and is really, really strong woman. And it's actually really empowering to see that, too.
But it's got to be concerning when you see what it looks like to stand up and speak truth to power. Your mom has even received death threats. What does she say to you when she sees that you may be following in her path and taking that path less traveled?
Yeah, it's more of a safety thing, you know, just making sure that I'm aware of my surroundings. I do. It's a little bit of a different situation, only because I am younger, and so it's not as aggressive. But, you know, those comments do happen where people tell me, you know, things about going back to my country or things like that, even though I am, you know, born and raised in the United States. And so I've just kind of, like, learned to understand that, you know, these comments people make about me don't matter, and I shouldn't give power to them, because if I do give power to them, then they mean something. And I know that these comments are far from the truth, and I know my own truth. I believe in what I believe, and there's no point in, you know, I guess, feeling any harm from petty little comments from, you know, Twitter trolls or non-existent haters who don't know who I am.
progress has been happening, but it's incremental, and it needs to be dramatic. How do you stay motivated when the progress that you do see is a step-by-step incremental process, when what you need to really see, if you're going to meet the environmental goals of the year 2030, they need to be dramatic changes? How do you stay motivated?
Yeah, seeing 4 million people, you know, striking on one day is the most motivating thing I've ever seen. You know, for March 15th across the world, we had about 1 million, and then a few months later, we, you know, like over double that number. And so, seeing young people all over the world getting out on the streets, you know, skipping school, you know, for an entire day, you know, shows, you know, me and so many other organizers that progress is possible, and it doesn't matter how long it's going to take, because young people won't just allow it to keep happening. And if we don't see real change soon, then we'll continue to be out on the streets and for even longer periods of time, because we are running out of time here, and if anybody's going to do it, it's going to be young people.
Is there another climate strike planned? Shannon, Lisa?
Hey, look, what I want to add here, too, is, you know, it just so happens to be EPA's Children's Health Month in October. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what an insult it is that so much action is not being taken while EPA is highlighting their apparent successes when it comes to children's health. You know, one thing I think, too, in terms of starting this movement, you know, with the toxic waste crisis is, you know, when I first started getting my feet wet with this issue, so much talk, you know, with very esteemed scientists and entrepreneurs was, how are we going to get to Mars one day and what that future might look like? And I remember going to these different sites, putting on what looks like a spacesuit of my own to protect me from what was in people's backyards where their children were playing. And there's something, you know, very messed up if, you know, we're looking to try to make Mars livable, and we can't even keep our own planet livable. So,
as if there's a planet B.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Isha Clark, what keeps you motivated?
You know, my biggest motivator is taking all of this, you know, chaos and fear and anger and turning it into drive, and really telling myself that there is no other option but for us to solve this climate crisis. And I can never stop moving, because if I get disheartened and stop working, then exactly what I'm afraid of is going to come to pass. So I just have to keep saying there's no other option but to solve this. And I believe that what you put out will manifest. So.
Well, Shannon, Lisa, you were saying that you had some plans for your life and they got shifted. I'm wondering, Isha, if you have a trajectory in your life that has changed as a result of your activism and dedication to this issue, what do you see yourself doing in the future?
You know, I have no idea. I know for one that I can never stop this fight. It's just, the stakes are too high. It's too important. And honestly, I'm too in love with this movement and how empowering it feels to be a part of it, to let it go. And so I don't know what that will mean for me. And I'm trying not to hold on to any specific plans. I've always been a planner, but that's really changed. I think that's something that's changed. I've always been a very strategic planner, and I have to do this to get to this point. And I'm at this point now, and I have to think 10 steps ahead. But with this this movement and this moment in history, you never know what's going to happen. And so you have to be flexible.
And how do people get involved with your organization, Youth Versus Apocalypse?
I think the best way to get involved is to go to youthversusapocalypse.org. We're currently in the process of updating our website so that we're going to have a bunch of different campaigns that people can get involved with. So that includes Last Chance Alliance, which is targeting Governor Newsom. There's this Dredging the Bay. So there's this plan to start dredging the bay, which is, there's more details on the website, but there's going to be a bunch of campaigns like that that anyone can get involved with. I would also highly recommend going to youthversusapocalypse.org and looking at our demands for the September 20th strike. Just educate yourself and normalize this conversation about not only climate change, but climate justice and what that means, and practicing intersectionality and really recognizing and centering frontline communities in our everyday lives.
What about dredging the bay? I think a lot of folks think it's a great idea. It'll increase transport. Just talk about that a bit.
You know, I'm going to be completely honest. I haven't done a lot of research about it. It's something that I recently learned about. But, you know, there's talk that it will help decrease carbon emissions. But really, and technically it will, but what I believe will really happen is that we're going to increase our exports. So that's going to increase the amount of petroleum products that are being exported, which is not worth lowering the carbon emissions for, because that's just going to continue the amount of carbon that's being put into the atmosphere globally. Mm-hmm. I believe that's what the issue is.
Well, again, it's an ongoing educate oneself situation.
Right.
As you
and I
along.
Need to educate myself, obviously.
We all do. I think that's the idea, though, right?
Right.
Everybody has to figure out where they get in, where you fit in.
Right.
And figure out what's happening around them.
Right. And there's always something new. That's mm-hmm. the other thing. There's always something new to learn about. There's always something that you didn't realize that can help you understand something that's going on in the current moment. So even all of us that are sitting at this table have to be constantly re-educating ourselves and looking at the facts and rethinking what we're doing in the moment that will help adequately address what's really happening. So that's a challenge that we all have to take on.
Especially rethinking what you think you already know.
Right.
That's a real challenge.
Right.
Shannon Lisa, Edison Wetlands Association, how can people get involved with what you're doing?
Yeah, so we have a website at www.edisonwetlands.org, and we post updates pretty regularly for our investigations, especially that having to do with the Franklin, Indiana site. Something that we kind of have in the works right now that we're looking to do is to do a petition to the White House, because, as you know, I mentioned before, Franklin is not an anomaly when it comes to this issue. And I encourage, you know, all of your listeners to really be environmental detectives in their own communities as well and try to look at what problems might be going on there. But, you know, we really want to start a national movement with these sites that are believed to be cleaned up or believed by the government to be done and don't have to be touched anymore, you know, to be inventoried and have that level of oversight that's needed so that it doesn't take young people like myself and Isha and Isra to uncover these issues, that the government actually does their job. And, you know, threats from the outside and threats on our borders have been used for a while now to justify building walls and building bombs. But when you really dig deep and look at it, you know, it's not threats from other countries, you know, that is the worst harm to our families and children. It really is the wholesale poisoning of our nation and the failure of government at all levels. So
and the threat may be coming from inside the house.
Right.
Isra Hirsi, Youth Climate Strike, with about a minute left. How do people get involved with what you're doing?
Right. So the next national strike date will be on December 6th, so that just look out for that. And then you can follow U.S. Youth Climate Strike on Instagram and Twitter at U.S. Climate Strike, and we'll be posting updates about the next strike. So keep a lookout for that, and you'll be seeing hopefully even more on December 6th.
Isra Hirsi, U.S. Youth Climate Strike, Shannon Lisa, Edison Wetlands Association, and Isha Clark, Youth Versus Apocalypse. Thank all three of you award winners for your hard work, and keep it up.
Thank you.
It's been wonderful having you.
Thank you so much.
Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. Leah Cesarine produced today's show, and our social media producer, Chief Engineer Phil Hartman, and Kevin Vance is the studio engineer. We thank you so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. It's Your Call.